By 333 CE, a new city had risen, one in which paganism was in the process of being removed. It was also a city in which the defeat of the Jews was emphasized, but the Jews refused to forget. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 115, Jews on the Mount. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was in the year 333 CE that a Christian pilgrim from Bordeaux journeyed to the Holy Land. What he found was a city in the process of transformation from the pagan Alia Capitolina that had once been into a Christian locale. The Roman temples had been destroyed, and in their place, churches were being built in celebration of and devotion to the empire's new faith. Of the Jews, this pilgrim said little, but what he did say is enormously intriguing, and his report highlights the Jewish refusal, in the face of newfound difficulties, to forget Jerusalem. Let us begin with Simon Montefiore's succinct summation of the changes wrought by Constantine on Jerusalem and the world, starting Constantine's story in a time when the empire was still divided between East and West. Quote, in 313, Constantine and the Eastern Emperor Licinius granted toleration and privileges to the Christians in their Edict of Milan, but it was only in 324 that Constantine, now aged 51, defeated Licinius to unite the empire. He tried to impose Christian chastity across his domains and ban pagan sacrifices, sacred prostitution, religious orgies, and gladiatorial shows, replacing them with chariot racing. That year he moved his capital eastwards, founding his second Rome on the site of a Greek town called Byzantium on the Bosphorus, a gateway between Europe and Asia. This soon became known as Constantinople with its own patriarch, who now joined the Bishop of Rome and the Patriarchs of Alexandria and Antioch as the ruling powers of Christianity. The new faith suited Constantine's new style of kingship. Christianity had, from the earliest days of James, overseer of Jerusalem, developed a hierarchy of elders, presbyteroi, and overseers/bishops, episcopoi, in charge of regional dioceses. Constantine saw that Christianity, with its hierarchy, paralleled the organization of the Roman Empire. There would be one emperor, one state, one faith, end quote. Constantine himself never made it to Jerusalem, but the most famous visit of a family member was that of his mother, Helena, later a saint of both the Orthodox and Catholic Church. It was she who was behind the most famous Christian structure in Jerusalem, a central symbol of the city's depaganization, the edifice ultimately known to many Christians by the name of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But at the same time, the depaganizing of the city did not mean that Jerusalem would become more recognizably Jewish in any way. As Bishop Eusebius of Caesarea made clear, the new church that rose was meant to mark the city as one which replaced Jewish Jerusalem. Or as he put it, quote, a new Jerusalem was constructed over against the one so celebrated of old, end quote. He added that the previous destruction had been, quote, the effect of divine judgment on its impious people, end quote. And he further wrote that, quote, it may be that this was that second and new Jerusalem spoken of in the predictions of the prophets, concerning which such abundant testimony is given in the divinely inspired records, end quote. Thus, while later Christian conquerors of Jerusalem would show reverence for the Temple Mount, here, in Constantine's Christian city, the opposite was the case. Simon Goldhill, in his book Jerusalem, puts it this way, quote, when the Christians took over in Jerusalem in the 4th century, they cleared the Temple Mount of the exiguous signs of old Roman religion, no more than a couple of statues of the emperor, and then left the whole site as a rubbish dump. It stayed like that for more than 300 years. Helena and her son Constantine inaugurated a building program to memorialize the sites of Jesus' ministry, of which the grandest project was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but they deliberately left the Temple Mount empty, end quote. The fact that the Temple Mount was still desolate, Goldhill adds, was meant to be, quote, a visible sign that the Jews had been superseded by the triumphant new religion, end quote. Thus did the Temple Mount remain empty, desolate, but ultimately unforgotten by those whose faith and people had long made it the locus of their longing. It is with this in mind that we can turn to the interesting account of this Christian pilgrim, a work known as the Itinerarium Bertogallense, which gives us this pilgrim's description of Jerusalem in 333. The pilgrim anachronistically accords specific biblical meaning to various sites, referencing Solomon as well as the story of the killing of the prophet inside the temple, a biblical story that we have discussed in a much earlier episode. Our goal is not to focus on those descriptions, but rather to sift out the references made by the pilgrim to the Jews of his own period. Here is one selection from the Itinerarium. Quote, "Inside the wall of Zion is seen the place where was David's palace. Of seven synagogues which once were there, one alone remains. The rest are plowed over and sown upon, as said Isaiah the prophet. There is a great cornerstone, of which it was said, 'The stone which the builders rejected is become the head of the corner.' Under the pinnacle of the tower are many rooms, and here was Solomon's palace. There also is the chamber in which he sat and wrote the Book of Wisdom. This chamber is covered with a single stone. There are also large subterranean reservoirs for water and pools constructed with great labor. And in the building itself where stood the temple which Solomon built, they say that the blood of Zacharias, which was shed upon the stone pavement before the altar, remains to this day. There are also to be seen the marks of the nails in the shoes of the soldiers who slew him, throughout the whole enclosure, so plain that you would think they were impressed upon wax. There are two statues of Hadrian, and not far from the statues there is a perforated stone to which the Jews come every year and anoint it, bewail themselves with groans, rend their garments, and so depart." End quote. Let us try to analyze several parts of this passage. The first is the reference to the quote-unquote wall of Zion, at which, the pilgrim tells us, there was a synagogue. This may be a reference to Mount Zion, the elevated area outside the original Davidic city. Mount Zion was not the site of David's palace, and yet many ascribe a Davidic connection to it to this day. And by this I refer to the incorrect assumption that there David lies buried. An amusing and succinct summation of this legend is offered by Ari Zivotofsky. Quote, "The question regarding King David's tomb seems almost as inane as the riddle popularized by Groucho Marx on his 1950s game show, You Bet Your Life. In order to guarantee that no one left his show empty-handed, Marx would ask a losing contestant, who is buried in Grant's tomb?" And Zivotofsky later adds, "Unlike Marx's joke, however, the question concerning King David's burial site is not trivial. Signs direct visitors to Mount Zion through a series of anterooms to an interior room housing a cloth-covered granite cenotaph. This site is believed by many to be the tomb of King David. To locate King David's actual burial site, one need only consult the Bible to discover that King David died and was buried in Ir David, the city of David. To locate King David's actual burial site, one need only consult the Bible to discover that King David died and was buried in Ir David, the city of David. The same place, city of David, also appears in Samuel 2, which describes how the text states that David captured a fortress named Mitzudat Zion from the Jebusites and renamed it the City of David. Thus, in order to find his burial site, one needs to ascertain the location of Mitzudat Zion, i.e. the City of David. The present building housing the cenotaph was erected in 1335, but it is built on top of what is probably a 2nd to 4th century building. Little was known about the building until a shell exploded there during the War of Independence in 1948. Affording an opportunity for archaeological excavations during repair work. In 1951, an Israeli archaeologist and expert in synagogue architecture, Jacob Pinkerfeld, who was later killed in a terrorist attack at the 1956 archaeological convention at Ramat Rachel, carried out an archaeological survey. Behind the cenotaph of King David, Pinkerfeld found a niche that was part of the original structure of the building, and beneath the floor, he found three earlier floor levels, a Crusader floor, a late Roman or early Byzantine floor, and the plaster of the original building's floor. He noted that the niche was oriented towards the Temple Mount and concluded that the building was originally a synagogue, and the niche was the Aron, end quote, meaning the Ark. Thus, Mount Zion was not the site of King David's tomb or palace, but according to Jacob Pinkerfeld, it was the site of a synagogue at some point during the period that we are currently studying. The intriguing reference made by the pilgrim to the one synagogue left in Jerusalem may therefore indicate that at some point the Jews had been able to reform a community in the sacred city vicinity again. Or as Herschel Shanks wrote, quote, "The Jews maintained a small community once Hadrian's prohibition against Jews entering the city was no longer enforced. This community may have been centered around a synagogue on Mount Zion," end quote. Now, as Zivotofsky further points out, there are those who question Jacob Pinkerfeld's identification of the edifice on Mount Zion as a traditional synagogue. Though, if it was, it bears adding that there is a striking historical symmetry to a later period, for as we shall see, it was on Mount Zion that Jews would pray toward the Temple Mount between 1948 and 1967, when the old city was cut off. Be that as it may, wherever the synagogue referenced by the Christian pilgrim may have been, there is an even more intriguing reference that he makes to the Jews. Again, the pilgrim describes two statues of Hadrian, which in 333 were apparently still atop the Temple Mount, soon to be removed by Constantine's government. These two statues, as many note, are probably more accurately identified as one statue of Hadrian and one of Antoninus Pius. And then, again, the pilgrim wrote the following. Quote, "Not far from the statues there is a perforated stone, to which the Jews come every year and anoint it, bewail themselves with groans, rend their garments, and so depart." End quote. This, of course, is a description of the ninth of Av, on which apparently, in the decade of the 330s CE, Jews would come to the Temple Mount to mourn. The stone that, according to the pilgrim, they anointed seems to be what is now inside the Dome of the Rock, meaning what is known in Jewish tradition as the Evin Shetiyah, the foundation stone, the site of the Holy of Holies. This would mean that at least for some Jews at the time, it was assumed that the prohibition to enter that part of the Temple Mount did not apply so long as the temple was destroyed. And as we shall see, some Jews apparently had that view in the medieval period as well. As we shall also describe in later episodes, it was a different approach that was adopted as normative law, ultimately, so that later traditional Jewish visitors to the Temple Mount still visited, just as traditional Jewish visitors visit today on the Mount, but did not come that close to the rock itself. All this shall be discussed in later talks. But what the pilgrim's account reveals is something central to the story that we are trying to tell, a theme that we will emphasize as we discuss the next many centuries of Jerusalem. And that is the following. Jews never left the Temple Mount. They always attempted to enter the Temple Mount whenever they could, to mourn the destruction, to pray for the temple's restoration, just as, thank God, there are more traditional Jews visiting the Temple Mount today while still adhering to the dictates of Jewish law. By 333 CE, a new city had risen, one in which paganism was in the process of being removed. It was also a city in which the defeat of the Jews was emphasized. But the Jews refused to forget, anointing the Temple Mount with oil, and more importantly, sanctifying the Temple Mount with their tears, with their cries, and with their memories, thereby speaking down through the centuries to all of us. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.